Good morning, everyone. Welcome, whoever you are. My name is Jason Crow, and I'll be this morning's worship leader. Thank you for joining us on a humor-themed Sunday. We're going to try and have a few laughs and see what happens, see if I'm still welcome in this church next Sunday. Let's start by singing our opening hymn, which is Morning is Broken. It's number 38 in that dark gray hymnal. Number 38, Morning Has Broken. Please rise in body or spirit as you're willing and able once you find it. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Michael Johnson, and I am this morning's lay worship leader and assistant laughologist. Wildflower Church, wonderful beginning, a Unitarian Universalist congregation, is a place where we come to learn more about being human. We're not here because we've figured out life's questions. We're not here because we think we've got it right. We come here to learn more about being in relationship together, how to listen, how to forgive, how to be vulnerable, how to create trust and compassion in one another. And because it is International Joke Day today, we also come today to celebrate the endless and baffling mystery of laughter, Frito pies, and to share in the fun. In that light, I want to note for you that children under four laugh 200 to 300 times a day, while adults only laugh 4 to 20 times a day. I say we can do better, at least for today. After all, they're just kids. On some Sundays, we have the opportunity for one of our own church members to lead a service and follow a theme of their own devising. And today is one of those days. Our own Jason Crow conceived of and spearheaded today's service, dedicated to humor. Our minister will be back with us the last Sunday in July to repair whatever damage we do here today. I want to give special welcome to our first time and returning visitors, and I also want to assure those visiting that while we are a warm and fun group, we are not always as besotted by silliness as we will seem today. We are Unitarian Universalists, not Punitarian Unimirthalists. After the service, thank you for the groan. After the service, please be sure to join us for refreshments and conversation in the community room, which is to the left as you exit the sanctuary. We want to get to know you better and to answer any questions you may have. And for today, please bring your favorite joke. And now for our chalice lighting. Dagmar Greeter, will you come and light the chalice for us this morning? And you, if you will recite with me the words in your order of service. May the light we now kindle inspire us to use our powers to heal and not to harm, to help and not to hinder, to bless and not to curse, to laugh and not to mope, to uphold the spirit of freedom. It is our convention to take a few moments to greet each other, to get to know other people who we haven't met. And so if you would just rise and gather to talk to one another. Please come to the community room after the service to continue your conversations.
Okay. One additional announcement for those in the audience who are hecklers, mockers, and scoffers. For your convenience, the service may also be heard in the nursery across the courtyard. Now is the portion in our service when we have a reading, and today's congregational reading is in two parts. Please refer again to your order of worship, and let us read together the unison portion. And these are some selected quips by G.K. Chesterton. Mysticism is a transcendental form of common sense. Angels can fly because they take themselves lightly. There are two ways of getting home, and one is to stay there. Let your religion be less of a theory and more of a love affair. The poets have been mysteriously silent on the subject of cheese. Shh, this is serious. For the responsive portion of today's reading, you won't need to read any words because you already know the words. You ready? Knock, knock.
Who's there?
You. That all depends. Let me ask you a question instead. How many Unitarian Universalists does it take to change a light bulb?
How many?
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
You. Say you a third time without laughing, I dare you. Smart Alex. See, this is called reading the crowd, and here endeth the reading. So, you can stay seated, and let's sing another song. Hymn number 126, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. Number 126.
Thank you. Good morning. Here comes some more. I'm wondering if you can show me what your loud voices sound like. Very good. Can you show me what your quiet voices look like? Very good. Where are some good places to use your loud voice?
Outside.
Inside. Depends. Oh, it is? Okay. Well, how about like if you need to get somebody's attention from way far away? Would that be a good place to use your loud voice? Yeah. So, can you give me some examples of good places to use your quiet voice?
The library.
The library. Outside, you can use it there. Yes, ma'am. Sometimes at home, like maybe when someone's sleeping. Maybe in the church. Yeah, there's times when we need to have quiet voices in church, too. So today I'm going to tell you a story about a frog who likes to use his loud voice all the time. And there's a joke at the very end, so I want you to see if you can figure out what that's going to be. A loud-mouthed frog was curious about what different animals eat. So he came upon a mother owl, and he asked, "Mama owl, what do you feed your babies?" And the mama owl said, "Oh, mice and other critters." And the loud-mouthed frog said, "Okay, thank you." Cool. Oh, it sure is. So then the loudmouth frog came upon a mother giraffe, and he asked her, "Mama giraffe, what do you feed your babies?" And the mama giraffe said, "Leaves from the trees." And the loudmouth frog said, "Okay, thank you." And he hopped on his way. Then the loudmouth frog came upon a sparrow, and he asked the mother sparrow, "Mama sparrow, what do you feed your babies?" And the mama sparrow said, "Worms and other bugs." And the frog said, "Okay, thank you." And he hopped along his way. Finally, he came upon a mother alligator, and he said, "Predictions, I'm hearing predictions. Mama alligator, what do you feed your babies?" And the mama alligator said, "Loud-mouthed frogs." And so the frog said, "Yuki, thank you." And he hopped quickly on his way. That's the end of our story, and it's time for religious education class.
Good morning. My name is Dee Adams, and I'm a member of the Wildflower Church Board of Trustees. We believe that community matters here at Wildflower, and take some time in our services to share the ways we are living our mission to grow spiritually together, spreading love, justice, and joy. First, justice. Yesterday, 18 wildflowers, want to stand, those of you who were there at the Families Belong Together and Free Rally. And I understand there were about 8,000 people there yesterday. It was heartbreaking hearing the stories of families separated from their children and the way we treat those seeking asylum in this country. It makes it so imperative that we vote in November and create conditions for finally passing legislation to revamp our immigration statutes. The Texas Civil Rights Project, Children's Defense Fund, and the events page for this rally all have ways that you can engage and make a difference in this issue right now. Gay tells me this morning that our own Bethany Carson was interviewed on PBS related to the work she and others of grassroots leadership are doing related to people who are detained in Texas who are seeking asylum. Yay, Bethany. There's a lot of work to do. And our justice team was meeting this morning, and I bet they are cooking up some other ways that we can be engaged. Now for love, and love for those with mental illness. The social justice and pastoral care teams are sponsoring a Friday film this coming Friday, the 6th of July. I can't believe it's the 6th of July. Their shared focus for the third quarter is mental health. And the film, Alive Inside, is an uplifting documentary about the effects of music on people suffering from dementia and other mental illness. The film showing begins at 7. Next, love for our wildflower community. You may be getting a little tired of me mentioning this survey. But the Anti-Racist Multicultural Task Force really needs your input to be able to create strategies for our congregation that will engage us in this important work that we're doing to become an anti-racist and more multicultural community. So please take a few minutes to complete one of these. They're in the basket with the orange sign out in the foyer, and they're under the wall, with the circle wall in the community room. And speaking of the circle wall, how many of you have visited the wall and put your identities there? So there's lots of opportunity to visit it. Please do. There, you can really begin to get a picture of who we are as a community. So I invite you to do that today. Finally, joy. We are celebrating the Harris and Hampton family after the service today by imbibing in cake. And Mavis is really excited about that. They will be moving to, and I may be returning to, Asheville, North Carolina at the end of July. We are very sad to see them leaving. They have been with our community for a very long time, and they've become such an important part of our community. So we are going to miss them. Kara and Jeff and Mavis in Tallulah are going to, I'm sure, love being in the cooler Asheville area. So it's a bittersweet for us, but we wish you joy.
Once upon a time, most folks used the offering plate to fulfill their pledges of financial support to the church. Nowadays, a lot of people click on a website or set up automatic payments instead. Still others write a monthly check and place it in the plate. But passing the offering plate was always more than just a practical exercise. It's always been a ritual. Even if your pledge is paid up, it's worthwhile for you to bring just a dollar to drop into the plate as a ritual reminder that that form of love we call generosity is present in the room. If you're visiting for the first time, please allow the plate to pass, as your presence is gift enough. The offering will now be given and gratefully received.
Wait a minute.
What's that?
Why do you keep talking about plates? Those are not plates. Plates are things we pass at the dinner table.
Exactly. Yeah. Those are baskets. Yeah, look at mine. A tisket, a basket, a green, you know, a basket.
Well, they're kind of yellow, but they're certainly not green.
Well, I'm glad we got that sorted out. You may have...
Comedy legend Andy Kaufman is reported to have once asked his spiritual guru, "Teacher, is there a secret to being funny?" And the teacher's response, "Yes, silence." So we're going to do this prayer and meditation backwards. Instead of ending the prayer with a moment of silence, let's start with a moment of silence and see if Andy's guru was right. Just this once, I give you permission to giggle in church when you're not supposed to. So take a second to center yourself and settle into a spirit of stillness. Clear your mind. And whatever you do, don't think of anything funny. Let's see if we happen to hear the holy sound of maybe a contagious case of the church chuckles. And someone who just can't suppress a little giggle, guffaw, or don't feel like you have to hold it in just this once. It's fine. Let it out. Let it out. Just don't make a mess. I invite you to join me in silence, tears, or laughter. These are the words of Rabindranath Tagore. Is it beyond thee to be glad with the gladness of this rhythm? To be tossed and lost and broken in the whirl of this fearful joy? All things rush on, they stop not. They look not behind. No power can hold them back. They rush on. Keeping step with that restless, rapid music, seasons come dancing and pass away. Colors, tunes, and perfumes pour in endless cascades in the abounding joy that scatters and gives us and dies every moment. Amen.
So So this is no joke. Humor is sacred to me. It's holy. We get the gifts of funniness and amusement within us and between us and around us in abundance. For me, at least, that is soul-touching, soul-lifting, soul-saving. Humor brings the fresh breeze of relief from tension, the delightful aha when truth is revealed in silliness, the cheek-glowing tears of deep and mirthful connection. Humor is sacred, humor is holy, and I am a disciple. As such, for years, I have tried to be the funniest guy in the room. Like all things sacred, humor is elusive. We feel it, remember it, expect it, enjoy it. We can touch it like a snowflake in your palm, but we can never hold on to it. Deconstruct a joke, and you may see the convergent elements of the joke thing that caused you to spit milk into your friend's face as you burst into laughter. But by so doing, the joke itself, its heart, its whole, its funniness vanishes. Dissection renders the sweet, frail, fleeting thing dead on arrival. I wrote my dissertation on the psychology of humor. I read all of the research and wrote about it, and that was interesting, although not always fun. But I learned nothing to unravel the mystery of humor. It left me cold when it came to understanding my own yearning to be funny and to be amused. So I am a devotee and practitioner of an art that I find both sacred but can neither explain or define, and I cannot leave alone. I do know that in my life, humor plays at least three distinct roles: connection, offense, and defense. Connection. I love being funny, sharing funniness with other people, using humor to warm a relationship, making a difficult point to put people at ease. In our marriage, spontaneous funniness helps to strengthen our love and attachment. And humor, gently delivered, helps to soothe the inevitable hurts we inflict on each other. We couldn't do without it. Mary and I laugh a lot. I feel freer in my whimsy and imagination with her than with anyone else in the world. And my darling wife Mary has a special gift, the auto giggle. Once begun, the auto giggle is a perpetual motion laugh-o-matic. It requires only its own energy to fuel it to continue. It is a majestic, mirthful miracle. Last weekend, we were settling into nap, and I was playing with Mary's face as a baby plays with his mama's face, cheeks and chin and nose and lips and eyes, and I was making wordy, talky, silly sounds in rhythm with my touch. And behold, there it was, the amazing auto giggle, accompanied by her spluttering, because the only way you can talk when you're in auto giggle is to splutter. My husband is a very seriously silly man. In my work, I use humor gently and compassionately to show someone a part of themselves they are trying to avoid. Coming at such confrontations slightly askew with a bit of whimsy or incongruence softens the blow, provides amusement, and so buffers the anger, shame, and guilt that people often feel when confronted. With friends, I love riffing, punning, or finding the funny and absurd, horrible news of the day. Such warmth and joy from agile and unhinged imaginations is a delight. I enjoy joking with people I encounter in daily life, clerks, professionals, service people, folks in the elevator, bass players. When the moment is right, such light engagement brightens the day. And offense. I am no saint of humor, far from it. I make malicious jokes about people behind their backs. The smallish part of me recedes into judgment and criticism and arrogance, and that shows up as mean and sometimes barbaric humor. I don't like that part of me, but it's part of me, and I'm working to make it smaller. I used to do it in front of their backs. I hurt people directly with my wicked and mean-spirited humor. Aging and years of therapy have quieted that mostly. Now my sensitivity to my own self-corrective feelings of empathy, guilt, and shame curb the expressions of mean humor. And defense. I'm afraid of people. I'm afraid of you. Not that you're not all nice people. I know you are. You're kind, well-intended. Of course you are. Nope, it's not about you. I'm simply afraid of people. And it's not just me. Maybe you are too. Maybe all of us are sometimes afraid of each other. I know that mentioning my fear may throw you because I may not look scared. Along the way, I figured out how not to look afraid, sometimes not even to consciously feel afraid, but I am. And of course, right now I have stage fright standing here at the mic, but it's more than that. And I'm human, and like all humans, I have stranger wariness, but it's more than that. My fear also comes from the abuses and traumas of my family growing up, and all that I've endured since. Maybe all that's true for you too. And if so, I'm sorry. And I'm glad not to be alone. For me, that fear aggregates into the dreadful, gut-wrenching expectation that if you see me, really know who I am, you will find me sorely wanting. You won't like me, you'll reject me, and you'll run me out of town on a punchline. This primitive belief, bitter fruit of past wounds, really, lingers in the child in me. And that child in me is sure that if you see me, you will shun me, and I will die. I will surely die. Or so it feels. I'm not saying that I believe that as a 66-year-old, mostly grown man. I don't. But that old and awful fear has come up for me in years, so across many decades I have built elaborate defenses to cope with that fear, and humor is among my defenses. Making people laugh gets me high. The rush is proportionate to the number of people who get my joke and how much they laugh. With many people around, when a joke lands, when everyone laughs, I feel an incredible rush. That is not just a mental experience, it is a bodily experience. I feel a blast of warm, tingling energy through my body. It is a powerful, mood-altering experience with drug-like effectiveness. And when that happens, poof, my fear disappears. For just a moment, but it disappears. Fewer people, smaller laughs, smaller high, but on the same dimension. So it pays to be the funniest guy in the room. So joking works as a defense in my life, a defense against my once intolerable fear. This arrangement, of course, evolved unconsciously, as do all defenses, one fear, one person, one moment, one joke at a time. I'm not saying I wasn't aware of joking. Of course I was. I wasn't aware that I was building a defense until recent years. I got people to laugh. I felt high. It was a bit like being liked, and for that moment, the fear eased, and I felt safer. So armed with my sense of humor, I could deflect, disarm, and distract, and the high, the hit of making people laugh, lifted me up above my fear like a line of coke. I wanted to be and stay the funniest guy in the room. I had solved one problem, but I had created another. I could feel safe, and I could have a sort of tenuous pseudo-connection with people through jokes, but I hid behind the joke. I even became the joke. And pseudo-connection is really no connection at all. I was safe but isolated, and I was only as good as my last joke. Being addicted to using jokes to feel safe locked me out of learning to be brave and share my real self with people appropriately. So now on my journey of healing and growth, I'm working to reveal my authentic self and to reduce my defensive joking. I am willing to feel my fear without benefiting of joking. I'm willing to disconfirm my fear by deepening authentic connection with other people. I am moving toward a day when the only jokes I make reveal my true self and help me to connect with other people as I really am, even at the expense of being the funniest guy in the room. And that's no joke.
So now I'm expected to say something funny. Okay. Knock, knock. Stop it. Okay, how about this? How many Unitarian Universalists does it take to change a light bulb? I'm going to get to that, but first I'm going to tell you a story. I've never been much of a prankster, which is a little bit odd. I find pranks to be risky and prone to backfiring, kind of like a Wile E. Coyote trap. The victim could get really scared, and who knows what could happen. Or maybe they would just never forgive me. So I avoid pranks. I solemnly swear that I did not put any rubber snakes under the pews. You can look. It won't hurt my feelings. If there had been a way to equip the pews with whoopee cushions, I might have thought about it. So the following prank took place in 2007 when I was on the road with a rock band called the Rockland Eagles. Once or twice a year, we would take a rock and roll vacation together, and we would pile into the van, drive out to West Texas, play a couple of shows in Alpine and Terlingua, and hang out with the crazy folks in West Bend. And this is what happened on one such trip. Okay, let's see. We were somewhere around Barstow on the edge of the desert when the drugs began to take hold. Wait. Wrong story. We were somewhere around Fort Stockton on the edge of the desert when the long arm of the law began to take hold. The van got pulled over by a state trooper. And I'll never forget this guy, walking, talking stereotype of the Southern sheriff, the kind of cop everyone dreads, a real reactionary man. His name was Trooper Hare, and I remember that because his head was shaved, and that was the one and only indication that he had any sense of humor whatsoever. He said he was part of a special DEA task force looking for drugs on Interstate 20. So upon hearing this, our hearts all collectively sank because we knew what we were dealing with, what kind of goonish mentality we were about to have to deal with. We knew we all looked like a steak dinner to this cop, a van full of damned hippie rock and roll musicians from godless Austin. And Trooper Hare was just practically licking his lips with sinister glee. He was just sure that he was going to find a van full of drugs and Communist Party literature and bust us so hard that we wouldn't dare come back this way ever again. So he yanked us all out of the van, started running everyone's driver's license and searching the car for contraband. And for once, we did not have anything on us. And for once, nobody was smarting off to the cops. So after a few minutes of searching, Officer Hare couldn't find anything worse than an old open beer can in the back of the van. This made him mad, possum biting mad. He became increasingly agitated and intimidating to the point where he started making the other cops on the scene visibly uncomfortable. He wasn't about to just let us go without some kind of punishment, something stiffer than an open container ticket. He got back in his patrol car and sat there, digging for dirt on us for what seemed like about half an hour. And then he got out and he swaggered up to me and said, you put your hands behind your back right now. You got a warrant. Total surprise to me. As far as I knew, I thought I was clean. So I asked Trooper Hare if he was kidding. I realized I would have to explain to the man what kidding was. Apparently, 15 years prior, when I was 18 years old, I wrote a hot check for $4 worth of gasoline. And I forgot about it. Never bothered me again. Well, Travis County does not forget or forgive hot checks ever. Hear me, O Israel. So, Trooper Hare being quite pleased with his outstanding detective work, he cuffed me and he stuffed me. And he drove me to the Fort Stockton jail at well over 100 miles per hour. He was a busy, busy man. Lots of hippies' heads to bust. So now the dude is abiding in jail, still an hour's drive away from the gig and only about 3 hours from showtime. So my band, they all go into rally mode, and they manage somehow to scrape up the $1,000 of cash to bail me out. $1,000 because the warrant was out of Travis County. They don't deal with checks or credit cards or anything. So we called the club to let them know we'd be late. They picked me up from jail, and we drove exactly the speed limit to Alpine, Texas. And the whole way, the band is yelling and wagging their fingers at me while I ignore them and silently think hateful, fuming thoughts about the police. So we pulled into the parking lot of the club just as the opening band was finishing their last song, and we raced to get our equipment set up, and we started our first song right on time. Whew! Midway through the first song, another state trooper walks right up to the front of the stage, stands right in front of me, glaring at me, mustache, arms crossed, pair of handcuffs dangling in one hand. I can see them clearly. As soon as the song ended, he says, "You come here now." I said, "Yes, sir, yes, sir." He said, "I understand you got a warrant. You need to turn around and put your hands behind your back right now." So for the second time today, I'm flummoxed. I'm stunned, and I start stuttering something about, we just took care of that, officer, and there must be some mistake, officer. I showed him my hands. They still had fingerprint on my fingers from being booked into Fort Stockton. And he smiled. And I looked up, and the whole band was smiling. The club owner was smiling. The whole audience was smiling and starting to giggle. Word travels fast in a small town. You got me. I knew I had it coming on account of a chronic attitude problem. I knew I deserved it, but I didn't have time to think about all that right then, because right now there was a moment of truth that I had to deal with. 500 people were looking at me and laughing at me, waiting for a reaction, and by God, I was inclined to give them a reaction. So I knew I had to make a very quick choice. I could either die of embarrassment on the spot, or I could get mad and start cussing people out and threatening to fight the whole room, or I could roll with it and laugh at myself and take a bow. I'm not going to tell you which one I did. These are the times that try men's souls. Why is it that it's always hardest to laugh at yourself when it's the most important time to do so? It is for me anyway. I don't want to respond to embarrassment with grace and humor. I want to act like a Tyrannosaurus. Nobody likes a critic. But criticism can be one of the most valuable gifts in life, and everyone knows the best gifts to receive are gift wrapped in the funny papers. Except when the funny papers are just covering up something awful or hurtful, like Michael was mentioning, and therein lies the rub. It's no secret that I'm a big fan of Monty Python. Amen? Anybody? Amen? Okay, yeah. My kind of people. All right. Python John Cleese has often stated that all humor is essentially critical. Cleese provides a classic joke as an example. How do you make God laugh? Talk about your plans. It's a critical joke, but it's not mean. It's a general statement about the human condition. No one is singled out for ridicule or excluded because the joke includes everyone. I think this is an important point to consider, that all or nearly all humor is critical. I also see this quote being used as a dismissive kind of defense, words to repeat whenever someone complains that a joke is insensitive or mean-spirited. Mr. Cleese made it clear that that's not what he meant. So to me, that's almost like misusing a verse of scripture. At the very least, it's a failure to listen with an open heart. And, I'll give you an example of a critical wisecrack I once cracked, and you tell me if I crossed the line. The first time I ever served as a lay worship leader of a Wildflower Church Sunday worship service, we had a guest minister that day, some guy named Reverend Brian Ferguson. It would be the second time I'd heard Reverend Ferguson speak, so I was aware that he had a thick, noticeable Scottish accent. I was extremely nervous that day, as I had never before attempted anything quite like helping to lead or MC a church service. My whole family was here, and I'd been agonizing for weeks over what to say, writing and rewriting and rehearsing my script over and over again. As the service started, I began my opening monologue, and when I got to the part containing a brief bio of Reverend Ferguson, a hilarious thought popped into my head. So at the end of this bio, I ad-libbed the following. Reverend Ferguson has also been taking English lessons and is making some progress. So, that's my legacy. first joke I ever cracked as a lay leader and public representative of this church. It was not a good idea, and it went over like a lead balloon. Nobody laughed. They just kind of went, oh, that was, oh, I don't know. It wasn't in my script to say that. I don't know what bad part of my brain it came from. But then again, I believe that our sense of humor is the voice of God, as translated by the devil. So as soon as I said it, I instantly regretted my words, and I wished I could put them right back in my mouth, but there was no taking them back now. So pretty soon, I had it justified. I'd convinced myself that it was okay, no real harm done, because Reverend Ferguson was just a guest speaker. I'd probably never have to see him again. Oops. If you know Reverend Ferguson, you already know that he took it in stride and actually thought it was funny, although I have apologized to him more than once. What was I looking to gain by making that smart little remark? Social currency? That kind of adolescent way of impressing your friends by daring to make fun of authority figures? Was I trying to say something I wish I'd said to Trooper Hare so many years before? Whatever I was looking for, I did not get it. And I learned my lesson about mocking and scoffing at someone's accent, and I will never do it again. When it comes to critical comedy, well, recently it's been a rough time for people who mix comedy and political critique. Lots of people in lots of hot water over recent jokes, remarks, without mentioning any names or particular controversies. It all boils down to the sum of the same old tricky questions, the same old questions we will always have to wrestle with as people and as a society. Is it okay to say something that's really funny, but also really mean and personable about someone who's clearly abusing their position of power to hurt vulnerable people? Does free speech mean that anyone and anything is fair game? Where are the limits? What defines the boundary between standing up to speak truth to power and just stooping down to a low-down level? And there's the familiar backlash against political correctness. Is PC culture making the world a better place, or is it just humorless people hell-bent on destroying comedy by making all the good jokes off-limits, and soon we'll be nothing left with nothing but dad humor, or worse, church humor? There is an angel on one of my shoulders that commands my conscience to take the high road, and there's a devil on my other shoulder that declares it's only fair to hit back. There's an easy answer to all of this. Watch. How many Unitarian Universalists does it take to change the light bulb? I've already answered that question several times. Next question. See? Easy. The only real problem with political jokes is that sometimes they get elected. There you go. I tried to source that quote. Some people say it's Mark Twain. Some people say it's others. I didn't get a firm answer on that, but it was not me. First rule of comedy, thou shalt not steal. So there you go. All good humor is risky, and I don't know who said that either. So I'm going to take a little risk here to kind of wind things down. This is a story from the Buddhist tradition, and since I myself do not have background in Buddhism, I'm just going to read a version of this story from an authentic source rather than tell the story with apologies for my pronunciation. I'm not qualified to explain the deeper meaning of this story, but I'm absolutely sure you will get the point. If you've heard this story before, please remember, silence is golden and duct tape is silver. So this is the story of two Buddhist monks who lived in southeastern China, and their names were Su Dongpo and Fo Yin. Su Dongpo was an avid student of Buddhist teachings. He was quick-witted and humorous, and as a Zen Buddhism follower, he was very serious and self-disciplined. He often discussed Buddhism with his good friend, Zen master Fo Yin, and the two lived across the river from one another. One day, Su Dongpo felt inspired and wrote the following poem. I bow my head to the heaven within heaven, hairline rays illuminating the universe. The eight winds cannot move me, sitting still upon the purple golden lotus. The eight winds mentioned in the poem refer to interpersonal forces of the material world that drive and influence the hearts of people. The eight winds are praise, ridicule, honor, disgrace, gain, loss, pleasure, and misery. Su Dongpo was saying that he has attained a higher level of spirituality where these forces, these eight winds, no longer affect him. Impressed by himself, Su Dongpo sent a servant to hand carry this poem to Fu Yin. He was sure that his friend would be equally impressed. When Fu Yin read the poem, he immediately saw that it was both a tribute to the Buddha and a declaration of spiritual refinement. Smiling, the Zen master wrote a single word on the manuscript, fart. He then had it returned to Su Dongpo. Su Dongpo was expecting compliments and a seal of approval. When he saw what was written on the manuscript, he was shocked. He burst into anger. Why, that lousy old monk, how dare he insult me like this? He's got a lot of explaining to do. Full of indignation, he rushed out of his house and ordered a boat to ferry him to the other shore as quickly as possible. He wanted to find Fu Yin and demand an apology. However, Fu Yin's door was closed. On the door was a piece of paper for Su Dongpo, and the paper had the following two lines. The eight winds cannot move me. One fart blows me across the river. The minute we start taking ourselves too seriously, the universe may have ways of reminding us of the value of humility. So how many Unitarian Universalists does it take to change a light bulb? As I walk through this wicked world, searching for light in the darkness of insanity, I ask myself, is all hope lost? Is there only pain and hatred and misery? And each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing I wanna know. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Oh, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? And as I walk on through troubled times, my spirit gets so downhearted sometimes. So where are the strong? And who are the trusted? And where is the harmony, sweet harmony? And each time I feel it slipping away, there's one thing I wanna know. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Oh, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? So where are the strong? And who are the trusted? And where is the harmony, sweet harmony? And each time I feel it slipping away, just makes me wanna cry. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Oh, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? How many Unitarian Universalists does it take? Did I not answer that? Okay, this concludes our humor service. It's 42. The answer is 42. May our roots hold us close. May our wings set us free. Wait, we gotta sing a song first. What are we singing? Go lift it up. Yeah. I haven't had a whole lot of sleep. We're singing Go Lift It Up for our final hymn. That's 1057 in the bluish teal hymnal. Sorry, y'all. Now then, may our roots hold us close, may our wings set us free. Amen, and blessed be. And one more thing. Just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 19 miles a second, so it's reckoned the sun, which is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me, all the stars that we can see, are moving at 1,000,000 miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour, in a galaxy we call the Milky Way. The galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. It bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us it's just 3,000 light years wide. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at 1,000,000 miles a day. And the galaxy is only one of billions and billions, an amazing and expanding universe. The universe itself keeps on expanding and expanding in all of the directions it can whiz. As fast as it can go, the speed of light, you know, 186,000 miles per second, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up in space, 'cause there's none at all down here on Earth. Thank you very much. Go now in peace.